This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. One of the big winners in last Tuesday's midterm elections wasn't a candidate. Amendment 4 restores the rights to vote for people with felony convictions on completion of their sentences. That's about 1.5 million Floridians. Not included are those who are convicted of murder or sex crimes. Desmond Mead is the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He told Intersection that the coalition worked hard to make sure this amendment is implemented the way voters intended.
The language has been very clear from the very beginning, and once it is officially written into the Constitution, the language says that this shall happen no matter what. So we're very grateful for that, because remember, this campaign was above partisan politics. And now that we won, we don't want this engaged in any partisan politics.
And Mead says the amendment shouldn't suffer the same fate as previous amendments on medical marijuana and funding for Florida's environment.
Unlike previous initiatives that required the legislature to do something, this does not. I repeat, this does not require legislative or executive action in order to implement.
Joining us for more is Paul Heroux. He has a felony conviction and he's been involved with the rights restoration movement. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Glad to be here.
Also joined by Neil Voltz. He is the political director for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Neil, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Paul, I want to start with you. When this amendment passed, what went through your mind? Are you happy to see this thing part of the Florida Constitution?
Well, and actually, as many people who know me realize, I did not want this particular amendment to be the one that went through. However, it has, and like anybody in my position, what I want to see is a maximum number of people who have a felony conviction and are citizens in the state of Florida to be recognized as citizens with the right to vote. So at this point, whether or not I like the particular flavor of ice cream doesn't matter. Just pass the chocolate sauce and I'll help it to happen.
What were your misgivings about this particular amendment?
Well, actually, we may be faced with them still. I'm waiting to see on that particular point. This is a constitutional amendment, and historically, the state of Florida, if it doesn't like a constitutional amendment, can either ignore it, misinterpret it, or try to help it, like they're trying to help the medical marijuana amendment right now, and with regard to smokable, non-smokable, and so on, dragging their feet.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that we're faced with, is we have very possibly a Republican governor. We also have a Republican Congress.
You mean the legislature?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have a former governor who's going into the us versus them thing. And so what we have to do right now, in my opinion, is advertise the fact that we are fellow citizens and get people positive on both sides of the aisle to back us and get it, because otherwise we're in a position where people can gum up the works, and I don't want to see that.
Paul, I want to get into some of the sort of details about the amendment too with Neil in a moment, but before we do that, what was your path to getting involved in trying to advocate for rights restoration? I wonder too if you made an attempt to have your rights restored through the route that has been in place, under this administration and previous, where you have to basically petition before a board mm-hmm. of folks, including the governor, mm-hmm. the attorney general, and so forth. Did you try that first?
Okay. I got involved in this basically. My first day of involvement was October the 28th of 2009, which was my end of sentence date. You become an activist after that. But then I became involved with activist organizations here, including the FRRC, for several years. But when I got out, I was informed that the governor's kibosh of my situation was already in effect.
What does that mean?
Basically that I had to wait 7 years before I was able to apply for, which I had just recently reached.
Mm-hmm.
What we should have is, as we're talking about, an automatic system that freely, you know, once you have completed your sentence, you should go on, if mm-hmm. that's the way we're going to do it. What we have to do right now is define the words automatic, which are not defined. As a matter of fact, the word automatic isn't even in the amendment, and have it be as smooth as possible, because the Florida Department of State does not have anything in position yet mm-hmm. to do that. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm knocking on wood with regard to that.
Well, Neil, let me bring you in to the conversation. I spoke to Desmond Mead last week, and he is obviously very excited by the fact that this amendment passed pretty much overwhelmingly. And he also talked about the language, the care that was taken over putting that language into the amendment so that there isn't the opportunity for legislators to slow things down. It just basically happens. But walk me through that. I mean, folks like Paul Heroux here who have some concerns that maybe it won't, the rollout of this amendment won't be as smooth as it could be. Is there some validity in those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think any of us who, you know, has been involved in processes like this know that there are, you know, it's a step at a time process. So we look at the language. We know the language is tight, right? I mean, it states clearly that voting rights should be restored upon completion of the term of the sentence. We learned a lot from the medical marijuana language. We learned a lot from things that have gone forward. So it's written as a self-executing amendment, right? So on January 8th, we believe that people can go register, and that is the process that we're engaging in. We believe that there's registration, but there's also a commitment to civic engagement, that these are people, and we want to spend time with folks in their communities, encouraging folks to have that ownership mentality, to understand that 1.4 million people have been enfranchised, the largest reenfranchisement in one state's history and the fifth largest in the state in the history of our country. It's a big deal. And so we need to move forward. In terms of kind of the processes, yeah, you're right. Like, there are steps. The election needs to be certified. We're all watching the recounts, but we passed overwhelmingly, so that election can be certified. It needs to be written into the Constitution. It will be written into the Constitution. And we believe that the language is incredibly clear. The Florida Supreme Court, when they ruled the constitutionality of our language, they also thought it was incredibly clear as a self-executing amendment that does not need legislative help with the implementation. And we also believe that this process can begin immediately. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about it. I mean, you can hear it in my voice. This is people's lives, and this is the ability for people to have their voices heard in their communities, man. And I'm excited to go.
Okay, so what happens on January 8th then? Are you going to, is there going to be some kind of something to mark the fact that people will be trying to register to vote at that point in time? Do you have a plan to mobilize some of the folks who want to say they are going to be signing up to vote on that day?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to lay out a little bit more of the specifics in upcoming weeks. We don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. Right now, what we're doing is communicating with leaders throughout the state. FRC is an organization that has statewide infrastructure, statewide relationships with returning citizens. And so what we're doing is we're doing surveys and we're doing the state tour to talk to our leaders. And we're continuing to, what we believe is that a unified team wins. And so what we want to do is have some conversations, kick tires, and really dig into the specifics of what it is that we're talking about and let some things play out. You can't necessarily get to step four until you walk through step one. And the truth is there's still a recount process going on. Mm-hmm. And so for us, that's our step right now, is we believe that this is an opportunity in which public policy can be implemented. And we want to make sure that we're talking to folks who are impacted and their families and find out, hey, what is our priorities as it relates to this moment? This moment is an opportunity. If we continue to work together, we believe that this is a change opportunity in which we can change policies that have been holding back people for decades. And so we're trying to do all those things at the same time. And honestly, it's a step at a time. So for us, it's reminding people that January 8th is the moment when we can go register. How we get there and all the steps that we get there, we're still working that out.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with Neil Voltz of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition and former felon Paul Heroux, who's also been advocating for the restoration of voting rights.
Can I just say I'm also a former felon, you know, so that's I got involved through the process, you know, through getting my own felony conviction. So our entire organization is led by people who are formerly convicted. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate having the conversation alongside Paul and focusing on where we're going, because I think both of us agree we want to get as many people registered and on the playing field and fully engaged as possible.
Neil, in that case, let me ask you the same question I asked Paul. Did you try to petition the Clemency Board and get your rights restored that way?
I did. I filled out the paperwork. I got in line and realized, like so many other people did, just how broken our system was. And the truth is there's still you know, when you look at the clemency process and civil rights, and there's still steps to be taken in that arena too. But our system was incredibly broken, and the fact that we were one of four states that permanently barred people from accessing, you know, the full breadth of their citizenship as it relates to their vote. And so that's why we needed to make the changes that we did. Mm-hmm. I found it incredibly frustrating. A broken process that's not fully funded. They were not able to operate at a high level in terms of efficiency. And so I realized I wasn't alone in that moment. And you start to talk to other people. You're like, oh, you've been waiting for years too. No phone call. Oh, what about you? What do you? And you suddenly realize it's like, well, gosh, that is exactly the catalyst. It was the broken system, and it was the pain of the people who were dealing with it and the family members who saw it that provided the catalyst for the movement to get this put on the ballot. And I think that that's an important part of the story.
Neil, taking all that into consideration, it must have been a moment on November 6th to kind of sit back, and even though there's still some work ahead of you, to just reflect and say, we've done it, we've finally gotten something on the books where it looks like all these folks can vote again. That must have been a great moment.
Yeah, man. Truthfully, yeah. I wasn't emotionally prepared for it. It was, yeah, lots of tears, lots of hugs, and we just surrounded by our, you know, formerly convicted or returning citizens, or as we now say, returned citizens, family. I mean, it was like you just see face after face after face, and we're hugging each other. Think about another mom, another aunt, another neighbors. We've done life together for years, and this is a huge step forward, you know, in terms of an ability to be a full citizen in your community and have a say on the school board and have a say on how things operate. Like, it was an incredible moment. Like, mm-hmm. It was really cool, man.
Paul, let me bring you back into this conversation. I did talk to Desmond Eade, as I mentioned before, and he said, you know, he is going to be obviously lining up to register to vote. Mm-hmm. Will you be doing the same?
Of course. Nicely, the present application, whether you go online or you go to your local person, does say in the box, are you a convicted felon? And if yes, has your right been restored? So the checkbox is there. One of the things with regard to the Florida Supreme Court, when they heard this, which anybody can hear, it's 21 minutes long, and if you go to FSU's podcast site, you can listen to this. Everybody was excited about the idea, to be sure, but the question was, that came before was, how is the Secretary of State's office going to handle this? There was not a clear answer on this. Is there a time limit? There was no answer on this. What I am saying is, the people who voted for this, which were mostly not felons, let's face it, call your representatives and talk about how you're looking forward to having all of your citizens working with you. Those of us who are felons, if we can be in front of a camera showing that this is what we look like, we don't look like Willie Horton, we don't look like John Malkovich. We look like normal human beings who are fighting for our rights just like every other Floridian. That is what I would like to see, is to make people aware of how positive this is as soon as possible, so that those loopholes of time, that possibility of, gee, we have to do this, that, and the other thing, they realize that the people are for it on both sides of the aisle, because obviously conservatives voted for this.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what about that label then, felon? I mean, does that sit uncomfortably with you? Neil mentioned the phrase, the expression, returning citizen. I know a lot of folks in your situation prefer that because it has less of the stigma. What's your experience with that?
Speaking for myself, when I got out of, you know, it was, as I mentioned, October the 28th, I left prison, and I do not refer to myself as a returning citizen. I never left. The first thing that I did was get involved. Luckily, Occupy hit, and a number of us started talking to each other. I've belonged.
You're talking about the Occupy movement?
Back in 2011, when I first was able to find people to talk to. Mm-hmm. The fact is, I canvass Anna Eskamani. I was on her campaign, and we had a wonderful victory. But the point is, can I make phone calls? Yes. Can I canvass? Yes. Can I march? Yes. The only thing I can't do is vote. I am a citizen of the state of Florida, and I'm looking not so much for a restoration of my rights as a recognition of my rights.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that we can do this, when a person hears the word felon who knows me, they think me. And this is what felons in Florida have to start doing, is standing up not just for ourselves but for the community with them on other things, so that when people think felon, they think, yeah, Joe, who lives down the street, who was marching with me on such and so, heck yeah, I'm going to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
This is the important thing, is changing the image from the theory or myth of the felon that everybody has in their head to the reality of who we are. And the sooner we start advertising that, the more comfortable people will be.
Neil, is that a heavy lift, trying to turn around that perception that people might have, do you think?
I love listening to what Paul has to say, right? And two things struck, and to answer your question. One is there is a diversity within our community, you know. Paul has a personal opinion about kind of the label that he's more comfortable with. And I like that, right, because I think there are a variety of different perceptions about who felons are and who this group of people are. And we are a diverse group where we represent the diversity of our state. And so I think, you know, at every step, people understanding that is really important. You know, over a million people who voted for Ron DeSantis voted for Amendment 4. Like, this is not a monolithic, you know, group. And I understand that as the existing voters, and now we have a group of people who, you know, however that process ultimately plays out, are going to walk into that role as well. But we are a diverse group, and I think that's really important to getting to your question, which is, you know, people's perception of what is a felon or a former felon or a returning citizen or, you know, whatever that label might be. And I think Paul hit on what I think we have been doing and obviously need to do even more, which is, when I think about the 5 million plus people who voted on Election Day, they were not voting for those folks who voted for Amendment 4. They were not voting for an elected official. They were voting for a family member. They were voting for a friend. They were voting for a neighbor. They were voting for somebody. And those somebodies are people who had courage to stand up. When people ask me what my favorite part of this entire process is, it is without doubt the life change that I've seen in what I would call returning citizen leaders, thousands of them all across the state, people who 2 years ago wouldn't share a story about their felony conviction with their best friend. And yet, by the end of this process, they were standing up in front of their neighbors and their colleagues, in front of TV cameras even, talking about their story and humanizing this policy in a way that no discussion, no whiteboard, no policy description could ever do. It's about people. Mm-hmm. And that was part of our success in terms of getting Amendment 4 passed. And to Paul's point, I think it is a vital part of our continued success in terms of getting this implemented and ultimately getting people into our communities in a way that we can be fully engaged participants beyond, like, and again, I appreciate everything that Paul said. I think intelligent people can disagree, and that's a really cool thing, you know. So to build on what he said, like, I use full citizenship, you know, because I think there's a lid that was lifted on Tuesday night, mm-hmm. to allow for more participation. But ultimately, it's a process, and we all need to just keep moving forward, and, you know, understanding that this is, I think, a really sacred thing. Like, reenfranchisement is, if you dig into it and you really think about it, if you're a spiritual person, even if you're not, you know, it is, mm-hmm. there's something deep down inside of us that I think can connect with this in a very spiritual way, that understands what forgiveness and restoration and redemption actually are, mm-hmm. and that we've all needed at some point in our lives.
What do you think about that, Paul?
Actually, kudos on that with everything you said, Neil. One of the things that I found in my own experience is, I've spoken before in the Orange County Board of County Commissioners. I've spoken up in the state. And the fact that I am a convicted felon and a veteran of the Florida prison system is one of the first things I bring up, because I'm proud of it. No, it's because, number one, nobody can sneak up on me anymore and say, did you know he's a felon? Yeah, he told me. But the other thing is that so many people come up to me and say, I have been touched by this, either because they are a felon, they have family members and so on, and they are pleased to see us standing up and asserting our rights. And one of the things that I tell people is the whole, and this is one of the battles, is what is the right to vote if you allow it to be manipulated, unlike the freedom of speech or freedom of religion, where people get to set things, if we stand up and demand it, I lost my rights because of something I did. But if people do not protect my rights as a fellow citizen, they'll lose their rights because of what they didn't do. And this has happened before, where very simply, my father taught me this at his knee. He said, I don't care if the man's a jerk. If he's an American citizen, you fight for his rights. He was rather blunt by nature.
What do you think, Neil? Obviously, the folks who have been involved in the Rights Restoration Coalition, or even as Paul has been, just sort of fighting individually for rights restoration, obviously you're engaged, you're thinking about this process, but 1.5 million people is a lot of people. What's your sense of how politically engaged they are and how likely they are to roll up to Supervisor of Elections office and register to vote come January 8th or beyond?
I mean, hey, that's a great question. And, man, I'm a believer in walking things out. You know, I love data. I love analysis of different information. And there's a lot of it out there, you know, to try and answer that question based on past performance in other states and in other situations. And it's a little bit all over the place. So I'm not 100% sure, but I'll tell you that I believe in the process. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, by staying unified and being committed to people, you know, and the value that holds us together, that this idea that we can help restore our communities and our state while we're restoring ourselves, that if we believe that we can have incredible success one person at a time, one community at a time, in terms of fully embracing the idea of being a full participant in our communities. And I think that civic engagement is vital. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people when it came to the campaign, right? So I'm talking about people talking into our situation who had questions about, like, well, how will this impact, you know, my life and crime rates and things like that. Okay, so that was their perception, right? And we still have a long way to go on changing perceptions, what it means to be a changed person. But there was a connection amongst all of us. That civic engagement has a real multiplier effect in terms of in changing lives, but also changing communities. And so I think that, at least for our organization, our statewide effort is going to be to help engage people civically, to get them fully engaged. Yes, registering people is vital, and we'll be doing that. But we want to build the relationships and spend the time necessary to develop fully engaged people, because we think that that not only impacts that person's life, but the community in a dramatically and just in a better way.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you asked about the numbers and stuff like that, and I know you have smart listeners, and that's a great Google. You can spend hours digging into all that stuff and see the different studies, and please, I encourage people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But really, we got to walk it out, you know?
Well, Neil Voltz is the politics director for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Thank you so much for joining us, Neil.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Paul.
And Paul Heru has also been involved in rights restoration. Thank you so much, Paul.
It's a pleasure being here. Look forward to talking to you again, Neil.
Still to come on Intersection, a glimpse into the future of theme parks. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Theme parks are a big part of the Central Florida economy. And this week, the Orange County Convention Center hosts the biggest theme park trade show of them all. 90.7's Brendan Byrne inhaled the heady aroma of funnel cakes and took in some of the latest in water slides, virtual reality headsets, and bounce houses at the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions annual convention.
Well, we're here with Susie Story. Susie, thanks for having us.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, Susie, I was here last year. This is a lot different now than when I walked through the door last year. What are we looking at right now on the exhibition floor?
You are looking at a beehive of activity as over 1,100 exhibitors start to put together their booths, their displays, their rides, everything that they're going to be selling and displaying during IAAP Attractions Expo.
And kind of give us a sense of what this is going to look like when it's all put together.
It's amazing to see the sights, the sounds, the colors, the height. You're going to see rides, actual operating rides. You're going to see food. You're going to see huge displays of stuffed animals. You're going to be able to play carnival games. You're going to be able to play video games. Anything that's related to the attractions industry is here within the walls of the convention center. Across over here, we've got rides outside. We have exhibitions outside. It's really the place to come and see what is new and what's happening for the global attractions industry.
And who's the audience here? Who's coming in?
This is the place where the owners, the operators, the buyers, the decision makers for the attractions industry come. So it's everything from the local family entertainment center that you visit for a couple hours to play video games and miniature golf, all the way up to the destination theme parks around the world. And this is where everybody comes to get the ideas and to make investment and buying decisions for their facilities for the years to come.
So we're recording this about 4 or 5 days before the expo floor opens. How long have folks been here setting up?
We actually started building a new structure that's adjacent here to the convention center on Halloween, October 31st. Right now, everybody you can see is moving in. You can hear the trucks. People are building a lot. They've been doing that for the last couple days. And the show floor opens Tuesday morning right at 10 a.m. and really up until 9:59, we'll probably be still putting the finishing touches on it.
And what goes into kind of laying out the land here? Is there certain spaces for certain vendors? Will you find your funnel cakes on one end and your roller coasters on the other?
It's a little bit of everything. So this is the 100th anniversary of IAAPA, and the attractions industry is frankly much older than that. But we have many exhibitors who've been with us for 50 years, for 66 years and longer. So some of their placement is by seniority. They've been here forever, so they get to pick where they want to be. But then we also help particularly new attendees figure out where to go. So we have the water park pavilion. We have the food and beverage pavilion. We have a first-time exhibitors pavilion. But really, as you just go up and down the aisles, you can see a little bit of everything.
And as you're prepping for a show like this, and even working the show last year, you kind of get to see some trends in the amusement industry. What's an observation that you made? What's the hot new thing that we're going to see on the trade show floor this year?
The global attractions industry is dynamic and it's innovative and it's always building on the success that we have. So we continue to see a lot of advancements in technology. Over the last few years, we've seen a lot with virtual reality, where it used to be, you know, virtual reality could be related just to a video game, and now there's actually applications you can do a virtual reality roller coaster, so we see a lot of that. We see technology enhancements using mobile applications, so we have a lot of companies with software opportunities for reducing a wait in a queue line, for maybe mobile ordering your food, any of the services, any of the things that can help our members figure out ways to continue to make their guests happy, make them wait in line less, serve them faster, keep them happier. That's really what we're always building upon, and that's the type of thing you're going to see here.
Well, it looks like we're in the way, so why don't we take a walk out as it gets a little bit busier in here, and you can tell me about this building. So we're just walking through these big doors that lead out to near the parking lot area, and there's these two buildings that have popped up. Can you tell me a little bit about what these are, Susie?
Yes, absolutely. So this show actually attracts more than 35,000 attendees, and it is so big with our 1,100 exhibitors. We have literally grown outside the walls of the Orange County Convention Center. So what we're looking at right now is the Exploration Station. It's a structure that we started building October 31st, and it's dedicated just for IAAPA Attractions Expo. So inside these temporary walls, we actually have an additional 100 exhibitors that are going to be taking place. So again, they have food, they have tech, they have rides, they have go-karts, they have everything that you see inside the building. But the popularity of the show, the business that takes place during the show, we couldn't say no to all the companies that wanted to be here. So we came up with this creative solution, and that's with the Exploration Station.
And this is along with the whole outdoor setup you have too, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because that was the one that took me by surprise last year the most.
One of the things that makes the IAAPA Attractions Expo so unique is the fact that we actually have real rides. So when you come to the show, and if you're just pulling the parking lot, you can see everything from zip lines to rides to inflatables to lots of things outside. And it's for buyers to see how they work, see what it would look like, and start to envision how it could be in their own facilities. So you're right. So we have the outdoor exhibits. Then we've added Exploration Station, which is more indoor exhibits, but it's technically outside with the building. And then inside the building, we've got all the other exhibitors. So this is a really big show.
And it's over 1,100 exhibitors, you said?
Yes.
And there's a queue to get in still, right?
There is. There are 1,100 exhibitors, and they're from all over the world. So they are companies from more than 100 countries coming to show what's new in ride and tech and anything under the sun. And we still have over 100 exhibitors that are on wait lists that they would love to take part in the show because they know this is the show where the business of fun takes place. And they know this is the show that you want to take part in if you want to continue to advance the attractions industry.
Susie, talk to me a little bit about why it's here. I mean, this is Orlando. We're in the heart of the amusement industry here. Why is it so important that this annual event is here in Orlando?
IAAP Attractions Expo is truly the largest gathering of the global attractions industry. And Orlando, for many years, has been the unofficial epicenter of the attractions industry. You know, we started out with the many destination parks, but I think what a lot of people don't know is we actually have a lot of the manufacturers and suppliers right here in Central Florida that serve the industry. In fact, there's more than 250 companies in Florida alone that service the attractions industry. So because Florida is so well established, because we've got the great destination parks, people who work within the attractions industry visit Florida for meetings. They come in and out for conventions. To have everything here allows us to have this take part in the huge convention center. No other convention center in the country can hold this show. The Orange County Convention Center is a tremendous partner of ours. But also it allows our attendees the opportunity to visit and to compare and to see all the attractions on iDrive. They can go to the destination parks. They can learn more by doing and by taking part in educational tours and events and that sort of thing all around Orlando.
So what kind of impact does it have on the local economy here between the hospitality and the restaurants and those attractions that you mentioned?
We are very proud to say that the IAAP Attractions Expo actually contributes a great deal to the Orlando community. We're going to see about a $77 million impact just in this week alone, and that's from everything you just said, from staying in the hotel to dining out to going to all the different attractions and entertainment around town. So while our attendees and our guests are here, they're also having an impact, a positive impact here in Orlando.
And does this serve as kind of a way to get some of those companies to set up shop here and come to where the, you know, where the energy and the bustling is happening?
That's a really good point. You know, I think we'd love to say that that's a direct reflection of having the show here. But if you just look at the trends over the last number of years, you know, we see a lot of, like I said, manufacturers and suppliers who initially started off with maybe a small office here solely to serve the existing destination parks. But as their business has grown, as the industry have grown, they've hired more and they've become more centered here in Orlando so they can serve other parks, other attractions, frankly, all around the world.
Tell me a little bit about what else is happening here. So it's not just about the expo floor, right? There's seminars, there's training sessions. What else happens here during the week?
There is so much that goes on. So at IAAP Attractions Expo, it's really about the seeing, the buying, the connecting, and the learning. We have more than 100 education sessions that are taking place, and they're for all facets of the attractions industry. So there's sessions about how to continue to improve on safety standards. There's sessions on improving your bottom line. There's finance sessions. There's marketing sessions. There are senior executive sessions where executives and presidents actually speak and address so they can say, here's our experience and learn from each other. And then we have EduTours. And so those are exclusive opportunities for our attendees to go and do behind-the-scenes tours of some of the properties around here and learn you know, from some of the really well-established companies based in Orlando so they can share their best practices.
This is the 100th year. What has changed in those multiple decades of putting this on?
It's really interesting. You know, IAAPA has been around for 100 years. We've been celebrating all around the world this year. And, you know, there are lots of changes. Certainly, I think when IAAPA started 100 years ago, we didn't have the technology that we do today. But the bottom line is this industry is all about fun. This industry is about bringing people together, making connections, and that hasn't changed. And, you know, the rides might be a little bit more advanced than they were 100 years ago, but the bottom line is people get on them and have a safe, fun time, and they want to turn around and do it again. And that's what we continue to see in the industry. So what I find very interesting and what we get excited about is we're more like 100 years young. We're still continuing to advance. We're still continuing to grow. And we have this great foundation and history that we're just going to build on and continue to move forward with.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't the only thing that IAAPA does. Can you kind of key us into some of the things that you do the rest of the year when you're not putting on this massive exposition?
IAAPA is the largest global trade association serving the attractions industry. So we are more than just a week-long event here in Orlando. And we actually hold two other expositions around the world. We do one in Europe every year, and we do one in Asia as well. So next year in 2019, we'll be going to Shanghai, China for the Asian show, and then Paris, France for the European show. And those shows are continuing to grow, and in each year they're growing as well and seeing more and more attendance. But this one here in Orlando is the largest. It's the largest global gathering. And but what we want to do is serve the industry around the world. There's lots of emerging markets. The Asia-Pacific market is growing by leaps and bounds, and the Middle East is continuing to grow. So for us to be able to serve the members and help them set up with strong safety standards and understand best practices and really create great entertainment destinations, we want to be able to serve them. So we do all that we can all around the world.
And you're building a new headquarters here in Orlando, right?
Yes, the new headquarters are very excited about. We are in the process of building that. We broke ground in May, and we plan to move in sometime late summer of next year.
And that has to say something too, as you were mentioning before, that this is the epicenter for the amusement park industry, right? If the largest trade show is here and the largest trade organization is here in the city, then this has to be where it is.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we really took in mind when we relocated here from the Washington, D.C. area is being able to be close to our members, to be able to serve the members, and to be able to connect. And a huge part of the design of the building is, frankly, space dedicated just to members. Special meeting space, the opportunity to come together, the opportunity to maybe they have a flight and they don't want to sit in an airport. There's like a lounge for them. We've got a library with the history of the association and history of the industry. So, yes, it's a global headquarters, it's an office, but it's really the space for the industry to come together when they're in town and know that this is their place. This is the headquarters to see, touch, and be connected with the industry.
Now, do you have to be in the industry to come to this expo?
The IAPA Attractions Expo is not open to the public, unfortunately, as fun as it is. So, yes, you do have to be involved in some way. It doesn't matter what your title or your level is, but, you know, we have a lot of consultants to the industry. We have a lot of people who are new in their careers who are coming out, and they want to take part, and they want to learn and see and do. We know that there's a lot of connections that are made and networking, but it's not open to the public.
But you can see quite a bit on social media, right? You'll be sharing a lot?
Oh, absolutely. This is the week for fun with the social media for us. So anyone interested can follow us on Twitter, and it's at IAPAHQ. And our hashtag this year is IAE18.
And finally, when you're not running around like a crazy person, taking care of all of your duties this week, will you be on the trade show floor? Are you excited for this?
I love this. I've been thrilled to have been an attendee for many years and to now be, you know, here working with IAPA and actually helping put it on. I love it. I look forward to it. I personally eat my way around the show, so that's what I look forward to. But yes, it's really like a big homecoming. It's great to see members that you see maybe once a year or you email a lot, but to reconnect, and I absolutely love it.
And you can eat your way through the floor because it's miles and miles of walking, right?
More than 10 miles of aisles. So yes, the Fitbits and the pedometers and all that get quite the workout, and I'm still trying to decide what shoes I need for the week.
A very important thing to figure out, right?
Yes.
Susie Story with IAPA, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Intersection, The Hello Girls, an off-Broadway show about the women who served as telephone operators in the U.S. Army in World War I, premieres today. We revisit an interview with historian Elizabeth Cobbs about her book, which chronicles the wartime efforts of the Hello Girls and their fight for recognition as veterans. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Women who served as telephone operators in the U.S. Army in World War I are being celebrated in a new off-Broadway play. The Hello Girls opens today. In March this year, Intersection spoke to historian Elizabeth Cobb. She wrote a book by the same name about the women of the U.S. Army Signal Corps and their fight for recognition as veterans. Dr. Cobbs, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So you've written 7 books now of history or historical fiction. What made you want to focus on the story of these members of the U.S. Army back in World War I?
I wanted to write something about World War I because this is the centennial of it. And I thought, you know, maybe one of the usual suspects, Woodrow Wilson or the Treaty of Versailles. And then I thought, why not tell a story that we don't know, a story that had been lost to history?
How did you find it then, if it was kind of lost to history? Like what put it on your radar?
Good question. I mean, I was sort of, you know, digging around in the internet, and I came across this brief mention of these women who had gone to France and had served the United States and really in a way, the world, the cause of world peace. And I knew nothing about them, and I've been teaching history for 25 years.
So how important was the Signal Corps and, I guess, the new technology of the telephone at the time in helping the Allies win the war?
Well, technology really defines the First World War, and that's one of the things that makes it so horrific. I mean, actually, you know, this is the Signal Corps, and if you want to get a sense of how bad World War One was, a member of the British Signal Corps was J.R.R. Tolkien, and when he wanted to envision what the landscape of Mordor might look like, he brought to mind the landscape of northern France. And communications in wartime, in these terrible, horrific, technologically driven wars, was extraordinarily important because the front was immense. And a man could be under fire, and how does he get word back that maybe it's friendly fire? So the telephone could actually, the wires could be run right into a trench, and then that wire had to be connected to a phone, and somebody had to answer on the other end.
This is a bit of a sidebar, but that is fascinating about Tolkien being a member of that group of people. I'm just wondering if that had some influence on the creation of language that he put into Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
I think I'm talking with a fan here, possibly, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, in a way, you could say, how do you envision something so strange that maybe we even need a new language to describe it?
Well, back to the story of the women in the Signal Corps. I mean, you read the diaries and the letters of these women during the research for the book. Was there one story in particular that really jumped out and grabbed you?
Well, finding these diaries, of course, was the first trick because nobody knew anything about these women. So I just had a few names, and a friend of mine is quite the sleuth, and she's, you know, really crackerjack, like a detective almost. And I said, "Can you find me the descendants of a woman named Grace Banker?" Now, for women, they change their names when they get married, and then their daughters change their names. So it's a challenge to find somebody going back that far. But my friend called me up and said, "Well, as it turns out, I think her daughter might live in a nursing home in Vermont." And so that was the beginning of tracking down the diary of, yes, this one young woman who was 25, and 1 week did not know if she was even going to be selected for the U.S. Army, and the next week was fingerprinted, had a background check, and was told that she would lead the first contingent to France.
Was there any kind of censorship of those diaries? Because letters home got censored, right? Do you know if they were allowed to write some of the things they were writing about what they were up to?
What an interesting question, because yes, they were a little naughty. And the funny thing is, Grace Banker here, she's the leader of the whole thing, and she's charged with making sure that the first women in the U.S. Army comport themselves with absolute discretion and everything else, and she kept a diary. So I was curious about that, and I actually went to her college, Barnard College, which is associated with Columbia University, which was then all male, and I said to Barnard, "Do you know what Grace Banker majored in? She was class of 1915. And they said, "Oh, yes, French and history."
Kind of cool finding a fellow history graduate in the course of your research.
Yeah, it was. The tip-off was all of her descriptions of, "Oh, and look at this ancient place in France and this ancient place in England." I'm thinking, you know what? I think she was so interested in it because she was a historian, and I'm so glad because their story, much of it, would have been lost.
That must be one of the best things about being a historian and researching and having access to those first-hand documents, accounts of what it was like to be there, right?
It is. It's thrilling. I always feel with history, it's like looking through a beaded curtain, and your job as a historian is to reach through those beads and bring somebody back out for us all to know.
So did the members of the Signal Corps that you write about in your book, did they talk much about their experience of the war when they came home? Because that is something that I think has been a challenge for other veterans of wars, coming back and describing what they saw and what they experienced.
Well, Grace Banker wrote in the 1930s, before World War II, she wrote that if you had been in a war, it would make you a pacifist. That nobody could see those people come back. Nobody could walk into a field hospital, as they all did. When these women were not answering the phones, often on 12-hour shifts, many of them visited the hospitals, which were right next door, because some of them were so close to the front lines that they saw men march out and they saw them come back on stretchers.
Elizabeth Cobbs, they were finally given veteran status in 1979, so a long time after the First World War. How did they make that happen? How did that finally come about?
Well, can you believe that, Matthew? 60 years. So they got back, and unlike women who had by then served with the U.S. Marines and Navy here at home and in conditions of safety, the women who went over across the seas, you know, submarines chasing them, who served in France, got home, and the U.S. Army told them they had never truly been soldiers. And so unlike the 11,000 women in the other branches of the armed forces, they got no veterans benefits, no victory medal, not a flag on their coffins. And so a handful of them, most of them, by the way, took it like soldiers do, yes, sir, no, sir, you know, button up. But there were a group of them, and one of them was the woman who named Merle Egan, who had been in charge of the phones at the Versailles Peace Conference and, you know, taking the calls between Woodrow Wilson and David Lloyd George of England and Georges Clemenceau of France. And she just couldn't take that lying down. And so for 60 years, she and another women petitioned Congress, wrote presidents from FDR to Dwight Eisenhower to, you know, Richard Nixon to Jimmy Carter. And it was actually under Jimmy Carter that these women finally won their victory medals. And as Merle Egan said when she got it, she was given her medal at a U.S. Army fort in Seattle. And she said, "I deserve this medal not only for serving in France, but for fighting the U.S. Army for 60 years and winning."
There's been a lot to change in the U.S. military since 1979, since they were given that recognition as veteran status. You know, for example, 2015, the U.S. Defense Secretary, then Defense Secretary Ash Carter, announcing that all military roles would be open to women by the start of 2016. There are still some barriers, though, right? I'm wondering if you have a sense of what's left to overcome for women in the military, in the U.S. military now.
Today, women are about 15% of the U.S. military. So there's still a tiny fraction of the, or small group within the overall military. There's still questions about what kinds of combat roles they can serve. And of course, women are beginning to move into those areas. But I think that we still have this challenge for all of us to think about, what is it that women can do? I mean, we tend to see these things as being anomalous or different rather than saying, no, this is something, these are jobs and responsibilities that all of us can embrace and can do well at.
It's kind of crazy to reflect, though, that you had this group of women and others in the U.S. military serving alongside the men in the military, and yet they still didn't have the right to vote back in World War I.
That is funny, but it's also not, because historically, men who didn't own property were soldiers before they were voters, and the American Revolution sort of proved that if you're willing to pick up a musket for your country, you should have the vote, and that's how actually the property qualifications were dropped. Black men, African-American men, were fighters before they were voters. You know, the 14th Amendment and 13th Amendment, rather, abolishing slavery, and the 14th Amendment establishing citizenship preceded the 15th Amendment with a vote. So men without property, African-American men and women, and also, by the way, young people, those between 18 and 21, they fought in Vietnam, and that's why they ended up getting the vote.
Elizabeth Cobbs, one more question. You know, it feels like right now we're living through this time of momentous social upheaval. Does it kind of feel like that to you as a historian? Are you able to step back and sort of look at it and take a kind of a cool, collected look at it and say, you know, this is what it might look 20 years from now?
You know, as I'm quoting somebody else who said that, you know, that history is like a grammar lesson. The present always looks tense and the past always looks perfect. But, you know, the fact is that the past has always been tumultuous. I wrote another book very recently, came out last year, on Alexander Hamilton and his wife, Eliza Schuyler. And if you want to talk about rough partisanship, well, at least we're not, you know, killing each other in duels today. So I think that every generation, you know, feels that it's fighting for its life. And we are, in a way, but we've also made tremendous progress. And I'm sitting here talking to you. We're sitting here having this interview. And at the time of the Hello Girls, not only would that not have been technologically possible, but it wouldn't have been socially possible.
Well, Dr. Elizabeth Cobbs is the author of The Hello Girls, among others. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in March. On our website, you can find a link to NPR's story about the off-Broadway play The Hello Girls. That's at WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. We're in Spring Silent Drive. If you appreciate the kind of in-depth coverage of the issues in Central Florida that you hear on Intersection, show your support with a contribution. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.